Lieutenant Governor Shan Tsutsui is stepping down, a move that has further roiled what is turning out to be a turbulent election year. So far, his first designated successors have turned the job down, so we wonder who does want the job and why would they? Would a new LG be climbing onto a sinking ship in the wake of widespread criticism of the state's handling of the missile alert and its aftermath? Contributing editor Neil Milner is on hand to help us figure it all out. Good morning, Neil.
Hi, Chris.
There's a fair amount to figure out because we've got, what, five candidates running for the job of lieutenant governor next time around, and nobody seeming to want it now. What's the difference?
Well, the difference, the most immediate difference is that it isn't much, it's not going to be any job worth taking between now and election time. And that's basically for two reasons. One reason is that the lieutenant governorship is a valuable commodity if it's a stepping stone to something else.
As it used to be.
As it used to be, well, most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to be a stepping stone for this person because you have a bunch of lieutenant governor candidates on the Democratic side running who are clearly going to have a heads up and going to have the next election. The second thing is it's just not much of a job anyway, and so you become a placeholder. And the reason that the president of the Senate and the House Majority Leader turned it down is that they have much more important things to do. They're not going to be able to keep that office anyway, and they don't necessarily have aspirations for a higher level of government. So it's essentially a kind of non-job that exists that has to be filled constitutionally.
The trouble is I think it's five people running for the job in November are running on the basis of I'm going to be able to get a great deal accomplished. They're not saying it's a non.
Well, you don't run
for
office by saying I'm going to sit on my keister for 4 years and not do anything. It's an important job if the governor that you're accompanying allows it to be an important job, mm-hmm. and it has been for some. It certainly was a clear stepping stone for Ben Cayetano, for George Ariyoshi, even for Mazie Hirono, partly because they had bigger political aspirations, but because they were clearly identified with certain kind of projects that the governor allowed to carry out.
Mm-hmm.
That's highly problematical if the governor doesn't want to do it. You can't, you know, it's like you can't get homework if the teacher says you're not supposed to be in this class at all. So you really don't know. I mean, this is an interesting group of candidates who are running, and one of the candidates, Kimi Romoto, already said, it shows the job right now is just a placeholder. It's a nothing job. I'm going to make it work for myself. But that's the problem that you have. Some states don't even have lieutenant governors, actually.
Everybody, you know, running for the job of lieutenant governor says in one form or another, I'm going to make it into something. But it's not necessarily up to them.
No, it isn't up to them. It's really up to the governor.
Yeah.
You have some initiative, but it's primarily up to the governor because the actual tasks that you have constitutionally are pretty limited, which means if someone doesn't give you something important to do, then you won't have it. If someone gives you a lot of stuff to do, Brian Schatz, by the way, is, of course, another person who jumped up from lieutenant governor. All of those people that I mentioned had already had a lot of political experience and undoubtedly higher political aspirations,
mm-hmm.
which, by the way, Tsutsui really never really seemed to have. So the combination of those things make the lieutenant governorship more important. And I think that's why you have the candidates you have running for it. They see it as a possibility for bigger things.
Well, but, you know, that the governor's choice of what to do with the LG makes it a bit of a wild card until the primary. It's, you know, you run separate paths.
That's right.
To the primary, and then you end up as a ticket, and it can be a kind of a strange bedfellows kind of thing.
Well,
you might not have planned to running with that particular.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the classic example of how campaigning is prose and campaigning is poetry and governing is prose. You can say whatever you want right now.
Yeah.
And it's possible that whoever is the candidate for governor, whoever wins the Democratic primary, and here we're just talking about Democrats, that earlier on, during the primary, one of them might say something in favor of one candidate over the other.
Mm-hmm.
There's not necessarily an advantage to that. So that's where it's likely to stand, that you really, you can say what you want about what you would like to do and show that you have aspirations and show that you're smart, but it ultimately comes down to the fact that you're pretty much a creature of the governor's work.
I'm just wondering if there aren't going to be two currents here, and one of them, namely the difficulty of finding someone to put in the job after Shansetsui, that whole process tends to discredit and undermine the value of the job, because here these people are turning it down, saying, hey, listen, where I'm able to do more where I am, as we go down the various dominoes in the line of succession. So you're going to have a few months of basically discrediting the job of LG, and then, you know, five or six people running, telling you how important it's going to be that they get the job.
Well, that's right. Listen, if you can't figure out how to do that, you probably shouldn't be running for office. That's the ultimate challenge, right? That's what these people have to do. By the way, if you're now past any legislator who's constitutionally aligned for the job, the attorney general is next, a cabinet level official.
Yeah.
If the attorney general doesn't take it, and I think there are fairly good reasons why he won't, because he's running for Congress,
sure,
you're then down to three cabinet level officials, which I'm guessing I can't even name all three of them here.
Yeah.
And after that, it doesn't say anything. So, but my guess is you get one of those people to be placeholders, because they're just less, there's less cost for them to do it.
This looks a little bit like a we need somebody to fall on a sword kind of a job. You
well,
know?
We need, yeah, although it's not quite that dramatic. We need someone to kind of there and not, if whoever is the lieutenant governor here is probably going to be best served by not getting involved in the Democratic primary on behalf of the sitting governor, not just because the governor's got a hard primary. You just don't want to do this. And if you bring in a cabinet-level official, they're less likely to be attuned to that. It's an odd job. I mean, it's falling on the sword is pretty dramatic, because I don't think if you do it right, you don't have to take any responsibility for what the governor is up to. I mean, you're not going to get blamed for the recent false missile attack. So I don't. It's an interesting notion about what this person is going to do every day when he or she shows up in the morning.
Well, it's always interesting when somebody leaves a job in state government to see what happens then, right?
Yes.
Ambitions get revealed. Aspirations get acted upon that we might have been only latent before.
Yeah, but the trouble with this is that it doesn't give you much time to have any kind of aspirations, because you can't run for the office in the fall, because that's already locked up. These people have already declared. So maybe you can build something. Maybe you can build something a little bit before. Generally, cabinet level officials don't have. There've been a few that have had political aspirations. They're pretty much cabinet level officials running their organization. So it's kind of a mystery. I mean, we shouldn't get all that excited about the next few months. And I don't think whoever's lieutenant governor is going to get all excited about the next few months either.
If drafted, will you run, Neil?
No, I will not, because I would have to give up my morning workouts, and I'm not ready to do this.
That's a good reason. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Political analyst Neil Milner is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View. He'll be back in 2 weeks. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the ongoing mission of Hawaii's ACLU. But first, your quiz. Ukaho'olawe, o Hawaii.
In today's backyard quiz, Clarissa Clara Ha'ili was born at the turn of a new century in 1901 in Honolulu and followed an unlikely path to stardom. She became one of Hawaii's most beloved entertainers. At first, her trademark comedy hula routine was just for the benefit for her students at Waipahu Elementary School. But after a while, she wanted to branch out. She loved to perform and began singing at venues around Oahu in 1936 as a member of a 25-voice chorale, Louise Akeo's Royal Hawaiian Girls Glee Club. As a member of the ensemble, she got a dollar a night. In one of those classic A Star Is Born episodes, one night on a cruise ship gig, she filled in for a performer who felt ill. She adapted a catchy tune by John McDermott Sr. and Johnny Noble to her quirky persona, making her attempts at a graceful hula into a comedic bit. That became her signature tune, and other hits followed. By the time she signed on to the cast of the legendary radio program Hawaii Calls, her future was assured. Today, we're looking for her stage name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for today's programming comes from Hawaii Opera Theater, presenting Donizetti's comedy The Daughter of the Regiment, February 9th, 11th, and 13th at the Blaisdell. Tickets at hawaiioperatheater.org.
The ACLU has long been regarded as a watchdog group with a long history of fighting what it sees as social injustice. Here in Hawaii, its roots go back to the 1950s, and some say it's more relevant than ever. Others see a group as a hindrance. Joining us today is Josh Wish, who has taken on the job leading the agency through this next chapter. Congratulations, Josh.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Okay, and let's get the elephant out of the room. For listeners who don't know, you used to work for the Attorney General, who is now running for another office.
Yes.
But what made you decide that you wanted to take this job with the ACLU?
Sure. And thanks for having me on to talk about it. What really made me decide that I wanted to put my name in for doing this, and I'm still counting myself as extraordinarily lucky that I get the opportunity, is really just the record of what the ACLU stands for. When you take a look at some of the rights, frankly, that I think so many people in Hawaii and across the country take for granted, you look through that history and you realize how much of it the ACLU was involved in. I mean, things like the right to counsel, the right to privacy, the right to have your Miranda rights read to you. Miranda was an ACLU case. The right to marry whoever you want, regardless of race. Loving versus Virginia. There was a movie made about it recently. That was an ACLU case, especially for important for so many people in Hawaii, including me, who are in marriages that have mixed races. And you take a look at that history, and the fact that what the ACLU has always done is defend people's civil liberties, regardless of partisanship, regardless of whether those stances are popular. And the chance to work with an organization that does something that's so clear to defend the Bill of Rights, something that I think everybody would generally be in favor of, was just something I couldn't pass up. As you know, they've had a tremendous history here in Hawaii ever since they were founded in 1965. Vanessa Chong, the outgoing ED, has done such a tremendous job over the past 30 years building up the local affiliate. I've got big shoes to fill, but it's work that I'm very excited to do.
Now, I know the ACLU original group started out with an immigrant, I think, rights issue. And like you mentioned, here in Hawaii, given our history, that's really important.
No, that is right. When I think you were talking about in the 1920s when the National was founded and what they called the Palmer Raids, which was when the then Attorney General of the United States started just rounding up people who they were suspected of somehow not being loyal and just rounding up and deporting them. And that was one of the things that really kicked off the ACLU. And you do take a look at how that ties into things locally. One example is yesterday, I think California had Korematsu Day. Basically, they recognized Fred Korematsu. And so for anyone who's listening who doesn't know that name off the bat, Fred Korematsu was one of the people who went to court to challenge being put into an internment camp in World War II just for being Japanese. That was a case also that the ACLU was involved with. And when you tie that right back into today, you see how important these issues still are, because that kind of thing ties right back into the travel ban, which is something that impacts nationally. It impacts locally, and it not only, I think, offends local sensibilities and the values of Hawaii, but it offends the Constitution.
Right, and you were working, you know, in the AG's office with the Hawaii versus Trump.
Yes,
complaint was filed, but a lot of people may not agree with the positions that the ACLU takes.
Yes. No, that's definitely true. And we know that. And that's, once again, one of the things that I do like about the organization is that it takes what it believes are the right positions, regardless of whether or not they're popular. One of the founders of the ACLU, a guy named Roger Baldwin, had said, and I'll see if I can actually get the quote right here, that the only test of our integrity of purpose is our willingness to defend persons with whom we totally disagree. So there may be things that the ACLU doesn't like are happening, but if the person who is trying to exercise those rights has a right to do it, the ACLU will defend them. And one of the ACLU adages is that sooner or later, everybody needs the Bill of Rights.
Now, one recent case involving the homeless camps that we were seeing in Kaka'ako, the city was under a lot of pressure to deal with that huge encampment of hundreds of people. I think the state lawmaker that got beat up on the streets there, you know, that only just focused everybody's attention about the need to break that up. And you folks filed a complaint on behalf of the homeless, and some felt that really kind of delayed the reaction and delayed getting things done.
When you take a look at that city case, what that was about in large part was about property rights. And the city, as we alleged, and then court subsequently ordered something that was in large part what we requested, was that the city was just getting rid of people's belongings. Now, when you're talking about someone who does not have a house, does not have an apartment, doesn't have a place to go to live, what might seem like garbage to one person could very much be their property. And just because someone else doesn't recognize the value of that property doesn't mean that the government simply has a right to throw it away. And that's what that was largely about.
Now, you mentioned earlier before the show when you were talking that you sometimes defend people whose opinions you don't necessarily agree with.
Yes. No, that's absolutely true. And the ACLU does have a history of doing that. There was a famous case back in the 70s or 80s, a Skokie case where there was a group of neo-Nazis that wanted to march through a town, and the ACLU defended their right to do it. And at the time, lost a lot of members as a result of that. But that was one of those cases where I think it really showed that regardless of whether something is popular, if someone has a constitutional right, then they'll do that. One recent example, something else that's – and let me actually back up and note one other thing. The ACLU not only is a non-governmental group, we don't take any government funds, it's a nonpartisan group, which is something that is very important. And so tying that back in, everyone has probably been reading in the news or listening about this the Nunes memo that the chair of the House Intelligence Committee in Congress wants to release a Republican-written memo about alleged misdeeds at the FBI. And there are a lot of progressives who don't think that that should be released. And the ACLU's position has been it should be released, but it should also be released at the same time that the Schiff memo, which is written by the minority party, is also released. Put all of that information out. The people have a right to know.
Okay. And then today, your office has released the results of a bail report. Talk about that. What's the importance of that?
Thank you. So just today, it's up on our website, acluhawaii.org. You can take a look at this. We've released what is a preliminary report talking about challenges with the bail practices in Hawaii. So what we're really talking about there are pretrial detainees. So these are people who have not been convicted of a crime. They have not even been tried for the crime for which they've been accused. And yet in Hawaii's jails, during the time of our study, about half of the population were pretrial detainees. So people who haven't even been convicted of a crime, but it's also significantly adding to the jail overcrowding problem that we have. And really the main reason that they're there is because they can't afford to get out. The average bail on Oahu is $20,000. And when you take a look at recent studies, I think the Federal Reserve had a study that most people can't afford a $400 unanticipated expense. That's a real problem. And we also know that this kind of thing disproportionately impacts communities of color. And in Hawaii, it disproportionately impacts, and we know this from OHA and UH studies in the past, Native Hawaiians, Pacific Islanders, Micronesians. And that is a real problem from a constitutional perspective.
And we're running out of time, but
sure.
I know there are bills that deal with bail that
yes.
I think the other day the House deferred it, or just the Senate deferred it?
Yes, the Senate deferred it. There is a House bill that is being heard tomorrow. House bill, I believe it is 2221. And that is something that we would certainly urge people to go and testify in favor of. And we're certainly hoping that passes. Regardless of what happens tomorrow, we're going to continue this work because this effort on our part is really a multi-year effort. As you'll see, for anyone who reads the report, we have recommendations for the legislature, for the judiciary. And as the legislature is looking right now at building a new OCCC, looking at bail reform and trying to make sure that we're not just building a new, bigger building, but reducing the population we have for people who don't really need to be there is more important than ever.
Okay. Josh Wish, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks a lot, Catherine.
Josh Wish is the new executive director for the ACLU of Hawaii. He most recently served as special assistant to the Hawaii Attorney General, Doug Chin. The ACLU of Hawaii just released a report on bail practices in the islands. You can find a copy of it on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm Anthony Brooks. Coming up on the next On Point, the next generation of farmers coming from our cities. We'll look at why millennial professionals are ditching suits for pitchforks. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
This afternoon at 2.
As the state's emergency management spokesman said yesterday, there probably should have been actions taken in the immediate aftermath of the January 13th missile alert. An internal investigation has revealed that the state employee who triggered the alert had been the focus of concern for a decade. Reporter Nick Gruby has the story in today's reality check from Civil Beat. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What that we didn't know before got revealed yesterday? Quite a bit, huh?
Yeah, we learned a lot yesterday about the false missile alert that was sent out. The first thing that came out was revealed by the FCC. And what they had said was that the missile alert was sent out because the employee who pushed the button, it was actually a mouse click, but
yeah.
Believed that there was actually a missile on its way here. So it wasn't a mistake as the way it was sort of couched by state officials here. Mm-hmm. And then later in the day, we learned from the state that this employee had a history of mistaking drills for practice with real events and had done that two times prior before sending out the false missile alert on January 13th.
One of the questions that arose in the light of what was revealed yesterday was, why weren't we told this earlier?
I think that is a really big question throughout this whole situation. I mean, there are a lot of questions that have been raised, including about whether or not the state has been fully forthright with the public and the press about what happened, when they knew it, and when they should be telling us. Because the information has really just been trickling out here, and in some cases it's been contradictory. I mean, there was the whole fiasco with the governor's office releasing an image of what the supposed screen looked like, and then after being ridiculed nationally for lack of design and user experience, mm-hmm. in that image, they sent out a second image that looked nothing like the first, which raises all sorts of questions about, you know, who's telling the truth here. And I think, you know, that's just been a problem throughout this whole situation. They fumbled the ball a lot.
It does seem, though, Nick, I don't know if it seemed that way to you, that the state has, you know, knowingly withheld a fair amount of information. It's been more than 2 weeks now.
Yeah, they haven't really told us everything. I mean, the report that did come out yesterday is detailed in the sense of that it did answer a lot of questions. But, you know, it also raises a lot more, one of those being whether or not there is proper oversight in the first place. I mean, here we have an employee who has a history of problems for many years, who has incredible responsibility when it comes to warning the state about an impending missile strike. Yet he was still in that position. And when that happens, I mean, you have to question whether or not he should have been there, whether he should have received more training, and whether there was more that could have been done by his immediate supervisors.
Well, we certainly haven't heard the last of this, Nick, so thanks very much for checking in with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Nick Gruby.
Hi, my name is Dr. Stephen Akula. I am the president and CEO of Legacy of Life Hawaii, and we've been working with Hawaii Public Radio for at least 5 years that I know of. I've always enjoyed working with Hawaii Public Radio. I'm a staunch supporter. I listen, and that's probably why we're an underwriter as well, because most of us at Legacy of Life Hawaii are listeners, and we believe staunchly in it, that it's something that needs to be done within our community.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
The Alawai Canal is a step closer to a bit of a facelift. It has the dubious distinction of being one of the nation's most polluted waterways, according to the EPA. It was first dredged in 1966, again in 1978, and most recently, 2002. So it's overdue for dredging and serious repairs. The aging 2-mile-long drainage canal was built as part of a flood control project, but over the years, the runoff from surrounding streams in neighborhoods like Manoa, Makiki, and Palolo has left the canal chock full of silt containing heavy metals and other pollutants. Cleaning will require the use of barges and could start this fall. And we've just learned that the final environmental impact study has been given the green light. It becomes official when the EIS is published, which could come as early as next week. Now, sitting down to talk with us this morning is J.N. Teruyanam, who's with the Engineering Division of the State's Department of Land and Natural Resources.
The Alawai Canal is a watershed for a 19-square-mile area. It's the area that is above Manoa, and in the area above Manoa, there's a large forest area with a lot of non-native trees. For example, you have a lot of albizia trees with very shallow roots, and the shallow roots don't hold the soil. So when it rains, the rain brings down all the sediments all the way from the top of the mountain all the way down to the Alawai Canal. So that's, you know, one reason why you have sediment buildup. In addition, you know, there's been urban development in the watershed, houses, apartments, shopping centers, and lots of roads. So anytime you have chemicals or oil on the road, fertilizers used in yards, all those, when it rains, all the fertilizers and oils all drain into the Alawai Canal. So you have the sediment buildup, you have the pollutants, and that's what is in the Alawai, and that's what we will be removing with the dredging project.
Right, and with all this stuff in there, I'm sure it makes the canal a less effective flood control project if you've got, if it's not that deep, if it's just full of gunk.
Yeah. So one advantage of dredging the canal is to, you know, remove the sediments so that there will be more holding capacity for the water when there's a big, intense storm. At the same time, we're hoping that with the dredging, the water will flow better, so there'll be better circulation after the dredging. So there'll be some, you know, slight improvement in water quality after the dredging and more holding capacity.
Right. And so tell our listeners, I guess, what makes this project, dredging the Alawai, different than the previous times that we've dredged?
Yeah. So in addition to dredging the Alawai, we will also be repairing wall sections that have deteriorated. You know, the canal is almost 100 years old, and we can, you know, expect that there would be damage to the walls. And so we have noticed some deteriorated sections. And so as part of this dredging project, which is different from the past dredging project, we will be repairing the walls. In addition, there is an existing Hawaiian Electric cable running across the canal. These cables interfere with our dredging project. So this time around, we have asked Hawaiian Electric to relocate their cables. And once Hawaiian Electric relocates the cables and de-energizes the existing cables, we will remove the existing cables and dredge the area near where the existing cables are. So these are the two big differences from the previous dredging project in 2002. Otherwise, we expect that the method that's used, the process, would all be, you know, very similar to the 2002 dredging project.
Now, my understanding about the Hawaiian Electric lines is that they do power much of Waikiki, and I think they've got a system for redundancy in there. But you know, Waikiki is our cash cow. It's a, you know, vital part of our economy. So that's a really important reason why it probably needs to be moved to make sure those lines aren't damaged in the, you know, in the future when we do additional dredging.
Yeah, so that's our concern. You know, we don't want to damage this very important electric cable, and that's the reason why we have asked Hawaiian Electric to, you know, relocate the cables.
And the process, describe that. So you'll be coming down the canal, and then when you're finished with the dredging, Hawaiian Electric comes in? Is that how that works?
You know, we are coordinating our work with Hawaiian Electric. We are going to work independently to dredge the canal. The canal is, you know, 2 miles long, so we'll be working, you know, section at a time. After Hawaiian Electric de-energizes the cable, it'll be safe for us to dredge in the area where the existing cables are. So we are coordinating our work with Hawaiian Electric and to make sure that, you know, the cables can be removed safely and the dredging can be done without affecting power to Waikiki.
But does Hawaiian Electric have to install the other lines?
The other lines will need to be installed, you know, before we can remove the existing cables, because, you know, Waikiki needs power. So once the new cables are in, Hawaiian Electric will be able to de-energize the old cables. And after the old cables are de-energized, that's when we will be, you know, removing the old cables. So we are coordinating our schedule and work with Hawaiian Electric. I will, you know, not try to, you know, speak too much about what Hawaiian Electric is doing, because they have their own program and project management. But we will work to dredge the canal. And because the canal dredging can be done section at a time, only after the cables are de-energized, we will go into that section to remove the cables and dredge that area.
Okay, and then I know there has been some discussion from the Army Corps of Engineers about a potential wall along one side of the canal there to help with the flood control issues.
Yeah, the Department of Land and Natural Resources, you know, is working closely with the Army Corps of Engineers on, you know, the Army Corps of Engineers' various efforts to, you know, minimize flooding risk in Waikiki and the surrounding area. However, this dredging project is independent of what the Army Corps plans to do in the future. It's independent because it has no, you know, strong relationship with the wall that they may be building or whatever they plan to construct to minimize flooding in Waikiki.
Right, so whether or not they build that wall, we definitely have to get in there now and repair the canal sides and the stairwells leading down there.
Yes, as well as to dredge the canal, because if there is a, you know, a high intensity storm, we want to be prepared by dredging the canal now as opposed to waiting 10, 15 years to dredge it if there are other projects that might come along at the same time.
We saw how last year the king tides were very high and the water was pretty much really up to the wall, and in some areas actually overlapping a little bit on the Alawai District Park side. So that was kind of an eye-opener. So I'm sure that this is all like tied in. If we can get the sediment down, the holding capacity, you know, is much better, is improved.
Yeah, the idea is to, you know, improve circulation in the canal and improve the holding capacity. So the dredging project will certainly help, you know, get the water moving quicker out of the watershed into the ocean.
And the Alawai is a popular recreational spot as well, with all the canoe halau, with their practices and the competitions. So how is that all being coordinated?
Yeah. So we have started our conversation with the kayak groups and the canoe groups. The dredging project will be done section at a time. We will not be shutting down the entire canal. We will do dredging one section at a time, and we will not be closing the entire width of the canal. We'll be working on one side at a time, so there'll be always space for kayakers and canoes to travel along the canal. And we are going to be asking the kayakers and canoes to tell us how they use the canal, where they launch from, when they use it. When we get the schedule from the kayakers and canoes, we'll share the schedule with the contractor, and the contractor will take into consideration these canoe schedule and the kayak schedule, and in turn will provide, you know, their own schedule, construction schedule, which we will share with the kayakers so that the kayakers can adjust their training or events to coincide with the work. So the work will have to go. We will do our best to minimize the impacts, but at the same time, once the schedule is prepared, you know, the construction has to move forward fairly quickly, and we're hoping that, you know, the kayakers can adjust their launching sites or schedule, practice schedule. So I think we will be able to, you know, minimize the impact on the kayakers. We will be going out to bid sometime in March. After we receive the bid, we will have to evaluate it and make a contract with the contractor. And, you know, best case scenario, we can start, you know, late 2018. The project will take about, you know, 1 year to complete. But because the canal is 2 miles long, you know, we'll be working section at a time. So, you know, any impact will be temporary and localized to, you know, the canoers or the residents. You know, no one will be impacted for the entire year. You know, they'll be impacted maybe, you know, 1 or 2 weeks at a time, and the barge will keep moving upstream.
Jayant Ruyanam is the branch head of Project Planning and Mineral Resource in DLNR's Engineering Division. He says the sediment dredged from the canal will likely be taken to an EPA-approved disposal site off the reef runway. And if all goes well, that project should be complete by the end of 2019.
Support for The Conversation comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Kumukahua Theater's historical drama, Wild Birds, about the education of Hawaiian royalty, this Friday and Saturday. MauiArts.org.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we reminded you of an entertainer whose comedic hula routines were broadcast via the radio show Hawaii Calls to 600 radio stations around the world. The former Clarissa Clara Hiley created a stage persona around her antics and her signature songs, When Hilo Hattie Does the Hilo Hop and The Cockeyed Mayor of Kaunakakai. The song was featured in the movie Song of the Islands. Her brash and bawdy style led some to call her the Polynesian Sophie Tucker. Her career lasted in the 1970s. She had a recurring role on the original Hawaii Five-O television program and held down a schedule of 2 shows a night, 6 nights a week at the Hilton Hawaiian Village Tapa Room. Hilo Hattie died of cancer on December 12, 1979. She's buried in the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific under her married name, Clara Nelson. But Hilo Hattie is the name we were looking for.
And congratulations to Wayne Gow, because he got it right. And that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, offering flexibility for on-the-go students and families with 24/7 access to Achieve 3000 Hawaii Edition, online or offline. Achieve3000.com.
Improvising musician the opportunity to craft an individual voice. It's a process that involves a million choices made along the way. The piano, which gives the artist control over melody, harmony, and rhythm all at once, may offer the broadest range of possibilities, or at least that's how it seems when you hear an artist like Joshua Kay take you inside his craft, as he did the other day. We talked about the process of finding your own voice.
I think it happens pretty automatically. But you're trying to make the music that you want to hear. And in that process, you're connecting with your own tastes of what you like and what you want to hear. Trying to make sure that you're looking for something that really resonates with you on an honest level, as opposed to, oh, this would be cool or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as you search for those things in the music that really move you on an honest level, those end up shaping your musical personality. And that really becomes what your musical voice is. So I think it happens automatically.
It isn't as if you wake up one morning having made that conscious decision.
No.
You've been deciding all along the line, I like this, I don't like that.
Right. Yeah, we just gravitate towards those things that we like and they become part of us.
Well, one of the things when you're learning, you know, when you're still getting your chops together, is that you have any number of examples that you could just flat out imitate. This is what Oscar Peterson did. This is what Bill Evans did. That's not really the answer, is it? It can be helpful along the way.
It's helpful along the way, but, yeah, that's not going to be the end result. But, yeah, it's part of the process is you know, I don't know if it's imitation, but certainly learning the music that they did, or maybe even out of curiosity, trying to attain a sound that they had in a certain part, see if you can do it. You know, you stumble across, oh, wow, that sounds really good, and that becomes something that you do more often.
I think, at least for a lot of musicians, imitation in the early stages is a big part of it.
Absolutely. And imitation Or is it just learning the music, you know? It's kind of, it's a blurry line. Because
mm-hmm.
at some point, you're just learning the song, you know? Are you imitating or are you just learning?
Yeah. As you get to the point where you sort of know who you are as a musician, does that sort of elevate the whole process of performing and becoming a musician? You know, does that sort of boost a kind of a self-confidence?
Well, I guess we can hope to think that we know who we are more than we did. But in any case, I think if you're searching for enjoyment in the process of the learning and the practicing and all of that, then it is going to elevate your experience. And, you know, you're going to just want to spend more time doing that. And it seems like you are getting deeper into it mm-hmm. to some degree.
Well, since you're sitting at the Bösendorfer, let's not fail to take advantage of that fact. Can you play something for us?
Sure. Could be anything, but I'm just going to start playing and see what happens.
Thank you.
Josh, what I heard from that was you started off with those chords that you held, which became the nearness of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I wondered at what point you decided to go into that tune, because it sounded as if those opening chords kind of suggested a number of possibilities. You could have gone a number of different ways.
They sure did. And, you know, that's something as a, you know, a lot of my life I've spent playing solo piano in restaurants or in hotels. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to keep the music going, even if I haven't decided exactly what I want to play next.
That's what it sounded like.
Yeah, that's what it is. And, you know, we call it vamping sometimes. And then, of course, I'm thinking, well, I'm in the key of F here. I was thinking of actually playing another tune that I, an original tune in the key of F. And then I thought, yeah, I really like the nearness of you. I think I'm just going to play a little of that.
Beautiful melody. I mean, but, and each time you referred to the melody, you were harmonizing it a little differently.
Yeah, that's just comes from all that work back there, working on possibilities, right? All the different ways you can get around.
Do you think the piano offers more opportunities for that than most other instruments?
Yeah, I think it's the greatest one, actually, for what you can do. Basically, getting a full sound really without feeling like you have to compromise, you know, it's amazing. And some of my favorite solo pianists have been the ones who got the full solo piano sound. There's a lot of jazz guys that really didn't do much solo playing.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Bill Evans was able to do nice solo work, and not as well-known Dave McKenna. Mm-hmm. It's just one of my favorites. And I almost thought about going a little bit more into a Dave McKenna style on that last tune. But yeah, he was great at just getting a very full sound at the solo piano. But yeah, it's a unique instrument in that you really can get everything you want, I think, to some degree without any other instruments.
And you refer to a couple of your influences, and that's kind of the process we were talking about as we started this conversation, the whole idea of, I like that Bill Evans voicing, I like that spirit in Dave McKenna's playing. And but it's kind of, as you become yourself, it's kind of a little bit of this and a little bit of that.
Yeah. We take things from them, and but it does become us. And yeah, it's a mix. We hear these pianists and we go, wow, I love that. How is he doing it?
Yeah, yeah.
Or she. So, you know, that's the journey. Let's figure it out. And I remember having that, you know, I moved to San Francisco after college and I started sitting in at jazz clubs and I got a job playing solo piano at Nordstrom, actually. Which eventually was my ticket out to Hawaii when they opened the Nordstrom out here. But anyway, I remember going into this one jazz club in North Beach and hearing Dick Hindman play, and I just went, oh, man, that's yeah. The sound. And it was just like head and shoulders above everything I'd heard. And it was just, that's the sound I'm looking for. How do I? I went and talked to him, and I started going to his house every week for 12 years. And I would still go, well, actually he passed away recently, but, you know, had I stayed in that area, I would have kept going to him because, you know, he had a lot of those secrets about getting that sound and, you know, a lot of those things that I wanted, so.
And that's the way a lot of those secrets get passed along, person to person.
Yeah. We seek out teachers. That's been how it's done.
Is that process going to continue into the future? Do you feel that happening? Now you're to the point where you can be a mentor to younger players.
Yeah, I have things to share, but I certainly always look for somebody to be a mentor to me. And, you know, anybody can be a mentor to us. But it was great having a teacher for that long. And, you know, if you can find people to learn from, it's a great thing. But yeah, and then sharing it with others.
Josh O'Kay will perform a solo piano concert in H. Harris Atherton studio this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. Up tomorrow, we'll sit down with Representative Greg Takeyama, chair of the House Committee on Public Safety, after the release of the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency report on the false missile threat.
Tell us what you think or suggest a story idea. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Find us on Facebook at The Conversation, or Twitter at HI Conversation. This show and all our past ones are available on The Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vanderkook.
And I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of The Conversation.